A fire in a South African apartment block leaves many dead and raises questions about why city officials did not support the residents. We'll go to Johannesburg. Also, a very small Catholic community in Asia gets a visit from the Pope.
People ask me, why is Pope Francis coming here? Because he would like to see the periphery.
The periphery, in this case, Mongolia. I'm Marco Werman, and in Cairo, aggressive urban development is threatening an ancient cemetery.
You know, who owns the bones of our ancestors?
And interest on U.S. student debt payments kicks back in tomorrow. In Denmark, university students have free tuition, plus they get paid to study.
It means that I don't have to work too much besides school. It helps with, like, you paying the rent and food, and then you don't have to think too much about it.
All that and more today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for tuning in today. We begin with some devastating news from Johannesburg, South Africa. A fire in an apartment building overnight killed at least 70 people. The dilapidated building was a temporary shelter for more than 200, including children. Many of the residents had no permanent housing. The fire started late last night. It's not clear how. Today, a spokesperson for emergency services, Robert Mulaudzi, described the difficult situation faced by rescuers when they entered the building.
They must just have a picture of an informal settlement inside the building. So therefore, the chances of one being trapped inside that building is they are very much higher because of, you know, the partitions and all the things which they are using to create those structures.
South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, visited the scene this afternoon and called the fire unprecedented.
Johannesburg has never had an incident like this where so many people die as a result of a fire in the center of the city. So this is tragic.
To hear more about this terrible news, I spoke with BBC correspondent Nomsa Maseko in Johannesburg.
Well, these are the type of buildings that are in the inner city of Johannesburg, the old central business district, which has been abandoned by businesses who went elsewhere. So some of those buildings were rented out as apartments. Others were abandoned by their owners, and others were taken over by criminal gangs, basically hijacked. That's the term that is being widely used here in South Africa. And this particular building in Marshalltown in downtown Johannesburg was a building that had been taken over by criminal gangs, and it is suspected that the more than 200 families that actually used to live there were paying rent to these criminal gangs. And there was a fire. No one knows how it started. But when a building is hijacked, what normally happens is that the government would cut electricity and water supply to such buildings. So the people who now live in these dilapidated buildings will be using paraffin stoves, particularly in the winter months, to cook, and candles, obviously, to provide some light.
Presumably, investigators will be looking at those ad hoc ways people stay warm as a possible cause, yes?
Yes, correct. Preliminary investigation seemed to think that it was possible that it was a candle that started the fire overnight.
Now, I understand children were known to be in the building. You mentioned families, so there are entire families living there, or were?
Absolutely, yes. Entire families have been living there. Back in 2019, I was in this building when city officials conducted a raid because there were complaints about the crime that was taking place there and the illegal occupation of these so-called hijacked buildings. And hundreds of undocumented African migrants from neighboring countries, including Zimbabwe, Malawi, Mozambique, were found to be living there. Many of them were deported. However, it is suspected that they still were able to make their way back here in South Africa from other countries.
If the cause turns out to be related to building services that were cut by the city, why would the city do that, cut heat and water?
Well, the city does that because they're trying to discourage people from just taking over and living in those places. But Johannesburg is a city where African migrants from neighboring countries come for better prospects of finding jobs, of a better life. The city says that they cut water supply and electricity to discourage people, but it hasn't stopped any of them, people who are still trying to make their way here in Johannesburg to build a better life for themselves and for their families.
I see this building is owned by the local municipality. What responsibility are they taking?
Well, the building was owned by the municipality and it was originally used as a shelter for abused women and children. But over the years, it turned into an informal settlement. The city of Johannesburg, the mayor who actually visited the scene, said that, you know, what happened was tragic, but they have been trying over the years to evacuate such buildings. There are even allegations that when they try and evacuate and raid such buildings, there will be NGOs that represent African migrants who live in South Africa that will take the government to court to say to them, if you want these people to go, the law in South Africa says that you have to find an alternative accommodation for them. The city says, well, it doesn't have the money to find other accommodation for them. So in a way, the politicians have been blamed and they are to blame for such an incident. This kind of thing is bound to happen in buildings that are right next to the building that got destroyed overnight.
It sounds like a lot of buildings there are in jeopardy of bad things happening. What has the government done to respond to housing issues faced by the people in this fire?
Well, there are some structures or shelters that have been set up, including the city hall or tents in the area to try and accommodate the just over 200 families that have been affected. Obviously, that is a temporary thing that is happening.
Finally, Noam, so what have we heard from people who managed to escape the blaze and where will they go now?
At this stage, there are still people who are still looking for their loved ones. Some were burned beyond recognition. Others, they were able to identify their loved ones at the mortuary. Others, I mean, the bodies were lined up on the side of the road, covered in body bags, and they were trying to identify as many family members as they possibly could. So for now, there is no permanent solution in terms of housing for them. But overnight, the city officials have said that they will find a temporary accommodation for them, especially those who say that they've lost everything. I mean, the entire building, people have lost their passports, their valuables. They have no form of being able to even salvage anything that was in that building. So there will be temporary accommodation for them, but a permanent solution is needed and very soon.
Just awful news. We've been speaking with BBC correspondent Nomsa Motseko. She joined us from Johannesburg. Nomsa, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Take care.
With more than 1.3 billion members, the Catholic Church is one of the largest religious institutions in world history. There are Catholic communities all across the globe. Pope Francis has gone out of his way to visit some of the smallest and most isolated ones. He's been to Bangladesh, Egypt, Iraq, and South Sudan. This week, the Pope lands in a country with hardly any Catholics at all, sending a message that none of his followers will be overlooked. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Pope Francis famously said all Catholic priests should be like shepherds, living not in lavish chambers, but among their flock.
Many times he said, the good shepherd, he must smell like sheep.
A good shepherd must smell like sheep. Father Jaroslav Verkovsky thinks the Pope is going to love Mongolia. The country's got plenty of shepherds and 10 times more sheep than people. Father Verkovsky, who's originally from the Czech Republic, lives in Mongolia among many shepherds, in a settlement of yurts, circular tents traditionally made of wood and cloth. They usually don't have plumbing.
Only few people have running water or central heating. Very poor houses.
No central heating in a country that, in the winter, gets down to negative 20 Fahrenheit. It's a strikingly beautiful place with harsh elements and not many visitors. But today, the Pope is coming. And even Catholics in Mongolia are saying, really? The Pope is coming to see us?
People ask me, why is Pope Francis coming here? Because he would like to see the periphery.
The periphery. The places where Catholics usually aren't. Francis is the first pope to visit Mongolia, a country of 3 million. They're mostly Buddhist or people following shamanism or no religion at all. Mongolia's 1,300 Catholics can all fit in a single cathedral. In modern Mongolia, religious freedom is pretty new. The country was communist until 1992, when it went democratic, and only then could Christians practice openly. So many Mongolians don't know who the Pope is, or much about Christians, period.
For Mongolia, they don't know about Jesus, and I don't try much to explain to them Catholic faith.
Otko Pasuk is a 30-year-old Mongolian Catholic. Call me Catherine, she says. Catherine doesn't try to convert others to her faith. It's hard enough explaining Catholicism to her own Buddhist parents.
My family or my relatives, they think that Pope is like a same status of Dalai Lama.
He's like our Dalai Lama, she says. And that helps her mom and dad understand. Catherine says Christians in Mongolia only spread their faith through social welfare programs, like schools or shelters for kids. Catherine got baptized 10 years ago after taking computer classes at a church. She says Catholics in Mongolia aren't persecuted or anything, but they can feel overlooked. That's why the Pope's four-day visit is a huge deal.
We are very excited for the coming of the Holy Father to our small country. It's an honor for us.
She says to Pope Francis, get ready to have lots of people handing him silver bowls full of milk. That's how they show respect to elders. I asked Catherine, what type of milk?
Horse. Cow milk.
Actually, she isn't totally sure. Horse milk is also presented ceremonially. She says the Pope will score points even with non-Catholics for drinking any type of milk. It's venerated as a source of sustenance out on the Mongolian steppes, where water is scarce. Father Vakovsky says that by coming to Mongolia, the Pope is saying to the world, even the most remote Catholic communities are precious.
Pope is fighting not for the rich church, but for the church in the middle of the poor.
In Mongolia, Pope Francis will meet the president in his fancy chambers, but he'll mostly spend time with local Catholics in their main church, which is made of stone and shaped like a giant yurt. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen.
A real-life bee movie in a suburb of Toronto yesterday morning.
5 million bees have fallen off a truck in Burlington.
The driver of the truck told Global News that he swerved to avoid something in the road, which resulted in what Tristan Jameson saw next as he gripped the steering wheel, 16 of his 44 beehive boxes smashing to the pavement.
Right now, there's a ton of bees just all over the place. We're waiting for them to calm down, relax, and come back to the hive and hopefully get as many bees out here as safely as possible.
Many of those beehive boxes were broken and spilled their trays drenched in honey. Much of the honeybee colony, millions of confused bees buzzing around aimlessly. Police were called in. Social media helped spread the word. Beekeeper Martin Marco told the CBC that he heard the news and decided to help.
I got my bee suit always in my truck and tools, whatever I need. So I stopped in and give a hand.
Police blocked off traffic. Bystanders watched as a dozen local beekeepers, dressed head to toe in protective white suits, wielded beehive smokers and coaxed the honeybees back into their boxes. Another beekeeper told the CBC about the damage he saw.
It was like walking through a war zone. I noticed a lot of dead bees on the road.
By midday, most of the colony had found its way back into the hive boxes. The truck driver loaded them onto his trailer for the rest of their 30-mile journey home. By day's end, though, there were still thousands of bees at the accident scene. News video showed clusters of bees crawling on neighborhood houses, cars, and mailboxes. The colony's owner, commercial beekeeper Alexander Haley, went to check things out. While he waited for the straggler bees to find the hives, he spoke to the CBC and said that despite the accident, he thinks his bees will get over the day's trauma.
See if we need to requeen, but hopefully these hives will make a strong recovery and queen themselves.
Most of the honeybees are now home, and some of Ontario's beekeepers can take pride in helping 5 million of their favorite creatures get through the ordeal. It was the creepy kiss seen around the world. The post-game incident after Spain's World Cup victory got a lot of global attention. Just ahead, how the scandal has impacted women's sports. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's been nearly 2 weeks since the final whistle on the pitch down under.
It is! Spain wins the World Cup!
But pure celebration quickly turned to protests, with players and many soccer fans around the world furious with Spain's Soccer Federation. They want President Luis Rubiales fired after he forced a kiss on star striker Jenny Hermoso following the championship win. Support for Hermoso has poured in from across the global soccer community, and as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, the story is also having an impact off the field.
Summer Hunter couldn't believe her eyes when she saw what Rubiales did to Hermoso.
Actually, I had to watch it back a few times because I felt like my eyes were lying to me because it was just such a bizarre thing to do.
At the same time, though, she says she wasn't entirely surprised.
sexism and misogyny has been a very normalized aspect of society and culture for forever, basically. You know, I mean, this is not a problem that is isolated just to Spain. I mean, this is a common problem everywhere.
In the past few years alone, several women's soccer teams around the world have accused their coaches, staff, and national federations of sexual harassment or abusive behavior, including in Zambia, Haiti, and Afghanistan. So this forced kiss was emblematic of a wider system that doesn't respect women, says Alex Colvin, the head of strategy and research at FIFPro, the global union for professional soccer players.
This is not just one man and one football team and one kiss. Actually, this is a systemic issue where women are treated and valued as less than, and they're operating in a system that doesn't work for them.
Hunter, a soccer journalist in Spain, says that system transcends soccer and sports altogether, which is why the response to this situation has been so widespread. Crowds of people have marched in the streets across Spain chanting in support of Hermoso and vowing to take down Rubiales. And Spanish singer Lola Indigo stopped a concert over the weekend to voice her support for the players.
Gracias a ti, gracias a todas las valientes.
She thanked the brave players and told the crowd to celebrate their World Cup win. Hunter says these are all signs of a mini revolution for societal justice, and she believes some men have started to listen.
And I think now people are asking the right questions, like the way that I've behaved my whole life or things that I've said my whole life, was it actually appropriate? Was it not appropriate?
Rubiales still refuses to resign from his position as president of the Spanish Soccer Federation, but FIFA has suspended him for 90 days, and Spanish prosecutors have opened a case against him for a possible crime of sexual aggression. Hunter says this swift and significant response has already made a fairly seismic shift in the culture.
It's actually been kind of heartwarming and refreshing to see that women in particular now feel as though they can speak up about their experiences when they were harassed or sexually assaulted or sexually abused in the workspace, because they know that they have the support and they know that people are going to listen, that they're going to believe them.
For Spain's women's national team, this fight leaves their short-term future pretty up in the air. All of the coaching staff has resigned, except head coach Jorge Vilda, who himself has been accused of mistreating players. And the entire World Cup squad refuses to play until Rubiales is removed. Hunter points out the team's next scheduled game is only a couple weeks away.
We could see the case where there's no team. They cancel the games.
In the long term, though, Hunter and FIFPro's Alex Colvin agree that these protests and this global response will likely benefit the momentum that women's sports has been building for decades, so that future generations can have an equitable system on and off the field. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The government in Egypt is transforming the capital, Cairo. Big development plans include new high-rise apartment blocks, highways, and bridges overlaying ancient cemeteries, including one called the City of the Dead. It's all part of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's plans to revamp Cairo and, quote, maximize land use for economic gains. This has many Egyptians up in arms. The World's Shireen Jafari is here with me to explain more. Shireen, sometimes you've got to tear down to build up. Tell us more about what's behind these demolitions.
Well, traffic is really bad in Cairo, and the government claims that these highways and bridges will help with that. It's also part of a plan called Cairo 2050. It's a project to modernize Cairo's infrastructure. But there are all these historic cemeteries, and that's what people are upset about. Some of the most prominent Egyptians have been buried in them. We're talking about historical figures, poets, artists, and writers. One urban researcher, Ibrahim Ezzeldin, described these cemeteries as kind of like open-air museums. He said there are marble tombstones and some of them are engraved with Arabic calligraphy. And all of that is now in danger as a result of the government's plan.
And as I understand it, Shireen, these cemeteries aren't only cities for the dead. People who are still alive also live there. Can you explain?
Yeah, exactly. People live in these cemeteries. Ezzeldin gave me a bit of background on this. He said people started moving in during a housing crisis in the early 1900s. At first, these were mainly caretakers, but then others joined them too. And now there are thousands of undertakers, flower sellers, calligraphers, and tomb carvers who live there. This is basically their home.
Yeah, so a lot of lives, I imagine, will be upended. Tell us more about how people are reacting to these plans.
Well, this is a very unpopular plan. Activists and relatives of those who are buried there are fighting it. And one of them is Hussein Omar. He's a historian and a writer. He says he has several family members, including his mother, buried at one of the cemeteries.
People are angry. They're very, very angry. You know, who owns the bones of our ancestors? I mean, who gets to decide? Who gets to decide whether we leave, whether we stay?
Omar says the government has told him that he can remove and relocate his mother's remains. He says some people have already done that, but he hasn't. He says the government should change its plans.
Yeah, so what is the final goal of all these development projects? Are they really about modernization, as the government claims?
Well, Ibrahim Ezzeddine, the researcher, told me President Sisi and his government want to turn Cairo into a city that's more like Dubai, you know, with futuristic skyscrapers and modern buildings and highways. As for Hussein Omar, he thinks this move is more about a land grab. He says these cemeteries are some of the most valuable pieces of real estate in Cairo and some of the only green spaces left. He remembered going to the City of the Dead when he was younger.
It was one of the very few places in Cairo where you could hear birdsong. And I remember as a child asking my grandmother, well, you know, what are these sounds? Because I'd growing up in the center of Cairo, I'd never really heard birdsong. And then, you know, we went into the City of the Dead and it was like really, really overwhelming.
He says in the past 3 or 4 years, the city's green spaces have been disappearing.
Massacres of trees, you know, literally pouring concrete over 19th century gardens, etc.
And that's why, Marco, he says he's fighting against the demolition of these cemeteries.
Wow, concrete poured over history and green spaces. The World's Shireen Jafari, thank you very much for telling us about this.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're with The World. When financial prosecutors go after sketchy global businessmen, it can often mean seizing their assets, like a luxury superyacht.
We've seized a lot of those yachts, but it's very, very difficult right now to ascertain who the true beneficial owner is.
A new banking law in Switzerland might make it easier. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Unilever, the very large enterprise that manufactures everything from beauty products to ice cream, has a big decision to make. Should it continue doing business in Russia or take the off-ramp and leave the country like so many other Western companies have done? Thousands of businesses have had to make that call since Russia invaded Ukraine and left. Many other international companies have also stayed put, despite Western financial sanctions on Russia. To find out why, we're turning to Rachel Ziemba. She's an adjunct senior fellow with the Center for New American Security and joins us from upstate New York. So Unilever is going to be deciding soon whether or not it should continue operating in Russia. Why has it not joined its Western counterparts and left?
It's been a function of two things. One, they're worried that if they just leave, that Russia will seize any money that they received in the past, might have retaliation against the workers. And because they produce in part food products and basic products, their argument was, well, you know, these are sort of basic needs that civilians need. However, you know, they continue to, you know, by staying, by operating, they're paying taxes to the Russian government. They participate in one-off sort of payments to the Kremlin that help to continue with the war effort. And so I think this is becoming a less tenable option. They don't want to make it easy for them to stay. You know, if you stay in Russia, you're supporting the war effort and military procurement implicitly. But they also don't want to let Westerners or anybody else take their money, take their equipment, take their expertise out.
So Unilever has also said if it leaves, its brands will suffer, and so will its 3,000 employees in Russia. For other companies that have stayed in Russia, do they make the same arguments, and how do you respond to those?
let's just say February 25th of last year, there were companies that made those arguments. Many of those companies have subsequently left despite those arguments. I think how you push back is to say, look, you know, your brands are already suffering if to the extent that they're affiliated with a Western, you know, player. These companies can't necessarily protect their employees from being conscripted into the war effort anyways.
And has that been happening?
There have definitely been companies from which people have been conscripted. Any sort of Russian men within the sort of appropriate age group are liable to be called up to serve in the military.
Have we seen examples of companies abandoning their business in Russia, walking away and just accepting the losses to their bottom line and potentially letting their brand be co-opted?
So I mean, there have been a number of companies that have done that. I think some of the earliest ones were those involved in the extractive industries, sort of oil and gas and otherwise, some that sort of left sort of, you know, right away. In a sense, some of the brands already got co-opted because they sort of chose to emphasize and continue producing the sort of Russian name sort of brands. So there are a lot of companies, Unilever among them, that to their shareholders, they've taken a lot of losses and write downs against their, you know, sort of Russian exposure.
Do you have any specific brands, and have those companies suffered any reputational hit as a result of this?
Recent companies that have just finally fled include Carlsberg, the beer company, companies like Nestle, others in that way. The research is mixed in terms of the reputational hit of leaving. I would argue that there's also been a big reputational hit for companies that have stayed. Now, it's hard to unpack that from all the other different reputational hits that companies face and economic hits. But in practice, some of, especially in the first few months of after last year's invasion, you could make an argument that companies that stayed had more of a reputational hit in their core markets than those who left.
Rachel, picking up on a previous thread, for a Western company that is still there, what is the business environment like right now in Russia?
Sure. So the business environment for private companies in Russia has become incredibly difficult. This is very much a country that has been consolidated around the government sector, the state-owned sector, the military procurement sector. So businesses have a lot of trouble accessing capital, accessing labor, accessing inputs. You know, this does tend to happen when countries are on a war footing. Even businesses that do continue, they're being asked to sort of pay more in taxes to support the war effort.
So all this is going on as Western sanctions continue to punish Russia for its actions in Ukraine. Do these businesses feel the effects of those sanctions?
They do. I mean, I think everyone in Russia feels some of the effects. One of the businesses and sectors that has been most affected by both the sanctions and the countermeasures has been the automotive industry. Russian production of cars basically collapsed last year and hasn't recovered. So that's just one example of local industrial production that has been impacted by sanctions because the automotive companies can't import the parts that they used to. And to the extent that they import the semiconductors and the auto parts, it's going toward military equipment.
I'm wondering if you see any compelling arguments that have not yet been made for Unilever or another biggie like Procter & Gamble that's still there to leave.
So I think a big argument to leave is that things are not going to get better. If anything, they're going to be asked to pay more wartime dividends to the government. They're probably going to find it more difficult to retain and protect the staff that they say is the reason that they're staying, and that they might face even more competition from Russian competitors. You know, as the Russian economy stagnates, the market size is falling. So these are some of the arguments. The challenge is that leaving Russia does mean abandoning most of the past profits and the like. It's also sort of recognizing that Russia's not going to be an environment for some of these Western companies to invest in for many years in the future.
Rachel Ziemba is an adjunct senior fellow with the Center for a New American Security. She joined us from upstate New York. Thanks very much for this. Very helpful.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sanctions on Russian interests, that's a long-term strategy as the war in Ukraine grinds on. A tool with more immediate effects, drones. Aerial attacks on Russia have escalated recently, with Ukraine targeting more and more military assets inside Russia. One notable example from this week, a Russian military airport in Pskov, 400 miles from Ukraine, was bombarded for 4 hours by successive waves of drones. Ukraine typically denies being behind attacks like these, but today, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky did say his military has deployed a weapon capable of such an attack. Russia, meanwhile, also used drones as well as missiles this week in its biggest bombardment of Kyiv in months. That's according to Ukrainian authorities. In other drone news, you may have heard that last weekend Ukraine struck a Russian airbase in Kursk, taking out 5 fighter jets. Since then, a Ukrainian diplomat confirmed on social media that the strikes on that airbase involved cardboard drones, a new tool in Ukraine's arsenal, provided by a contractor from Australia. Millions of Americans caught a break 3 years ago when the federal government hit pause on monthly student loan payments. It was one of those rare silver linings during the COVID pandemic. Well, that grace period ends tomorrow. Interest rates will kick in again. Payments are due in October. It's no secret that overall student debt here in the United States has ballooned in recent years, totaling more than all credit card debt and auto loans combined. This makes the U.S. an outlier globally. So today and tomorrow, we're looking at how people in other countries fund higher education. From the GBH newsroom here in Boston, Kirk Carapeza starts us off.
I know there are millions of Americans in this country who feel disappointed and discouraged or even a little bit angry about the court's decision today on student debt. And I must admit, I do too.
You could see President Joe Biden's frustration moments after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected his ambitious plan to forgive more than $400 billion in student loan debt. And that's a low estimate. Students in the U.S. are struggling to get out from under their loans. Some can't afford homes or cars. Others retire with outstanding student debt.
Student loans can work really well, and in many countries, they do work very well.
Economist Susan Donarski teaches at Harvard, and she backed Biden's plan because she says going to college shouldn't financially harm students.
We tell them that's the right thing to do, and it should not be that if they go to school, take out a moderately sized loan, that their finances can be destroyed by it.
So what can we learn from other countries?
Student loan repayment can be humane and sensitive to people's financial situations. And the more simple and automatic it is, the more effective it's going to be.
Donarski points to Scandinavian countries like Sweden and Norway, where education is widely seen as a public good. Or Germany, where the German word for debt is Schuld, the same word for guilt or shame. And the cost of tuition at public universities in these countries?
Tuition is free, but people take out loans for their living expenses.
Yes, she said free. Free college, though, doesn't guarantee efficiency. Take Argentina. When the South American country rewrote its constitution in 1949 to make education a right for all, lawmakers made tuition at public universities free. They also dropped entrance exams. But free tuition hasn't translated to better education outcomes. Degrees take 5 to 9 years to complete, years that students have to pay for food and rent. Today, Argentina has one of the highest college dropout rates in the world. In England, public universities charge high tuition fees compared to the rest of Europe, but the amount is capped at about $12,000. British economist Lorraine Dearden says an effective loan system helps students there.
Every single student who goes to university in the UK is entitled to a loan to fully pay their fees, and 95% of students take out these loans.
On average, students in the UK borrow twice as much as their US counterparts, which means there's actually a country where students owe more than Americans. But an income-based repayment system eases the burden.
The beauty of these loans is that they're done through employer withholding, so the student does nothing. When COVID struck in the UK, if you lost your job, you stopped paying your loan automatically because you didn't have a job, the employer didn't take it out.
We've recently seen what happens when there is no such flexibility with repayments. In Colombia, when COVID hit, borrowers who were out of work couldn't repay their loans. Dearden says the system imploded.
Colombia, as a result of that, has now changed to an income contingent loan for new students.
Loans can be a great option to fund your college education, unless you don't pay them back. In Africa, Nigeria recently introduced its new student loan scheme. Funded by oil revenue, it gives students 20 years for repayments with zero interest. Sounds great, right? Well, if you default, there are consequences, not just fines. You go to jail. For The World, Kirk Carapeza.
Jail time for defaulting on your student loans definitely sounds harsh. So imagine this. What if university education wasn't just free? What if students got paid to enroll in higher ed programs? That's actually the way things work in Denmark. The World's Joshua Koh, who is American and working toward his master's degree at Aarhus University in Denmark, reports.
I met Hannah Hirschbrung Lange, a bioengineering student here, out in front of the Royal Danish Library. It's next to a large park in the middle of the university campus. When it comes to finances, Hirschbrung Lange is a typical student at Aarhus.
I think it's like 5,200. I get like paid every month.
5,200 krona is equal to about 800 US dollars.
It means that I don't have to work too much besides school. It helps with like you paying the rent and food, and then you don't have to think too much about it.
The grant is available for 6 years, and in case of illness or pregnancy, students can apply for extra financial help. And like most Danes, they'll graduate owing nothing.
What I think about the US system, I think the US system is a little bit broken. You have to go into so much student debt.
Students might work part-time to earn extra spending money, and some students do end up taking out loans, but they aren't always used for school. Chemical engineering student Astrid Skifte Melsen went to Asia recently.
I needed on the long summer holiday to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand. I needed some money to cover that.
Melsen says she's not worried about being able to finish her studies and pay it back. The government subsidizes student loans with a low interest rate, and she'll have up to 15 years to pay it off. If you ask most Danes, they'll tell you that the generous subsidies and the free tuition is money well spent. Denmark has one of the highest graduation rates among wealthy countries. The Danish student grant system started 50 years ago.
The original idea is that if we didn't have it, then it would only be young people with rich parents that could afford an education.
That's Fenne Gross, an associate professor at Copenhagen Business School. Paying students to go to school was supposed to even the playing field. But that's not exactly how it's played out, she says.
We know that it is the more educated children and the richer children who actually go to college or university.
The country of just 6 million people decided a long time ago to prioritize a well-educated population, says Philip Schroeder. He teaches economics and business at Aarhus University.
So it's a small open economy. There's virtually no raw materials here apart from brains. And so that is a political agenda that always has been for changing governments. So education is for free.
Well, it's not free, of course. Danes do expect to pay for it later in the form of some of the highest taxes in the world. Periodic polls show that Danes are mostly happy paying for those taxes because of the services. They get medical care, subsidized child care, and unemployment benefits. But there have been grumblings that students are taking too long to get through school and that they aren't going into the fields that Denmark needs.
If you allocate resources and talent mass sensible in an economy, you don't want that to happen, that people train for something they can't, basically that no one in the job market wants, and then they have to settle for lower skilled jobs where they can't use the investment they have taken.
Schroeder also serves on a government commission to recommend reforms to higher education. Earlier this summer, the government did make some of the biggest reforms to higher education in years. They shortened the time to complete some master's degrees, and they're reallocating those savings to spend on training for nursing, teaching, and social work. There was no suggestion to get rid of free tuition for undergraduates, nor did they touch payments that go to students. Recent graduate Sigrid Strungevetter is not against reforms, but doesn't want the government to chip away at the right of every Dane to get a higher education.
It ensures that everybody, independently of their financial and socioeconomic background, can attend whatever studies they want to attend. And I am very comfortable paying high amounts of taxes when I'm getting a job, because I consider it the savings and college fund for my future children.
She says that higher education is seen as a greater social good, and it's been that way for generations past, and that's likely to be here for generations to come. For the World, I'm Joshua Koh.
That story is part of our Global Classroom series. It includes stories reported by and for students. Tomorrow we go to Cambodia, where some students become monks and live for free in monasteries in order to continue with their education. Over the years, Switzerland has tried to move past its reputation as a financial haven for the rich and shady. It is still a work in progress. For example, it continues to be possible for a company to be registered in Switzerland and also conceal the identity of the company's actual owners. This can present opportunities for money laundering. Now, there is a new proposed law in Switzerland that could change that. Maybe. To understand what's going on here, we reached out to Moyara Rusin. She's a professor of financial crime intelligence at the Middlebury Institute in Monterey. Mo, we'll get to this proposed new law in a second, but first, can you explain how individuals and entities use the financial industry in Switzerland for money laundering in the recent past?
Yes, there are lots of stories of wealthy individuals and global criminals using Switzerland to hide their assets. But those stories are old, and it got more difficult after Switzerland toughened its laws back in 1998. They still didn't have the best system for scrutinizing and looking for suspicious transactions because a lot of it was manual, and they didn't really fix that until 2019. But this new legislation, it's going to put them ahead of the U.S. in terms of checks and balances and controls that we have in place to try to prevent criminals from hiding behind anonymous shell companies.
So kind of draw us the basic contours of this proposed law and what it could do.
First thing it's going to do is set up a beneficial ownership registry so that any company, whether it be a shell company or a trust or a foundation that opens an account in Switzerland or already has an account in Switzerland, has to disclose who the true beneficial owners are.
So the phrase beneficial ownership here seems to be key. Explain more deeply what that is. Why is it so important?
So it has to be a living, breathing human being who has substantive control over those funds. So for example, if I'm a corrupt dictator and I want to put this account under the name of my spouse or child, the spouse or child isn't the beneficial owner. The dictator is the beneficial owner because they're the ones really controlling the funds. What a number of criminals do is they will list a nominee director of the company, and this is someone who just signs paperwork. Think of them as a straw man. But they sign over power of attorney to the true beneficial owner. So if you are a sanctioned oligarch, for example, they will have usually a nested ownership structure through many different shell companies, and then also try to hide behind a nominee director when they, say, purchase, say, a $100 million yacht, for example. Now, we've seized a lot of those yachts, but it's very, very difficult right now to ascertain who the true beneficial owner is. We think that this Russian oligarch owns that yacht, but it's really hard to prove. And what this means now is this sanctioned Russian oligarch will not be able to keep their funds in a Swiss bank account without disclosing that they are indeed the true beneficial owner behind that trust or foundation or shell company.
Mo, before this proposal becomes actual law, it needs to go through an extensive local and national consultation process where it might get redrafted. Even the bank lobby will get to weigh in. So in your opinion, what are the bare bones of this kind of law that need to survive for it to be meaningful?
Well, the beneficial ownership registry, that would put them in line with international standards. The United States is way behind the curve when it comes to setting up a beneficial ownership registry. And so I would be surprised if Switzerland did not move forward with that. The next piece of it, requiring lawyers and accountants to do their enhanced due diligence on their clients, that might face some pushback. The EU does require their lawyers to do enhanced due diligence on their clients. The US does not, and probably will not anytime soon. the American Bar Association is a very powerful lobbying group. And I don't know what the legal guild in Switzerland is like.
And if there are no changes to this law and it passes, what are we then looking at?
It puts the U.S. in an awkward position because we see ourselves as a standard setter, and we would have the weakest anti-money laundering regime among all the wealthier industrialized economies.
Wow. Moyara Rusin, Professor of Financial Crime Intelligence at the Middlebury Institute in Monterey. Thank you very much for this walkthrough of anti-money laundering enforcement in Switzerland. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
What did the distant past sound like? We know what it looked like, thanks to discoveries of pyramids and monuments, temples, markets, and dwellings. But what did it sound like? One archaeologist in Peru stumbled onto something that reveals a partial answer. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
Some of the best things happened by chance. Kevin Lane, an archaeologist at the University of Buenos Aires, was at a dig at Viejo San Gallego in Peru, a ritual site built sometime between 1000 and 1400 AD.
There was a series of two platforms, which we used to walk back and forth all the time, to be honest, especially because it's an open area. That's where we used to have lunch.
Lane noticed that the floor sounded hollow, like he could hear his footsteps reverberating a little bit. So, being an archaeologist, he decided to excavate.
Once we started digging, what we realized is that you have a series of different layers, so that you have a layer of guano, of animal dung, then that would be covered with a layer of clay and so forth. So that you get, because of the guano, you get sort of gaps. It's not as compacted, and that's what made the sound, especially being sealed by the different layers of clay.
This begged the question, why was there a poop stage in the middle of an ancient ritual site? Lane has a theory, which he laid out in a recent paper in the Journal of Anthropological Archaeology.
The fact that it's on a platform, the fact that it's looking towards this mountain, which would have been their local deity in the past, their local god, I am convinced that they've intentionally made a drum.
Or a drum stage, rather. So when a group of people stomped on it during a ritual dance to the lightning deity, the sound would boom and echo. It would sound like thunder, says Lane. The pounding and crashing, forging a sacred connection with the gods and the cosmos. I can almost hear it now. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.